I will call to order the meeting of the Newport City Council work session, April 4th, 2022. Roll call, please, Peggy.
Paul?
Here.
Parker?
Here.
Jacoby?
Here.
Kaplan?
Here.
Goble?
Here.
Bateo?
Here.
And Sawyer was not here for this meeting. What do you think, Spencer? Do we need to excuse him?
Sure.
No excuse for Dean.
Motion to excuse Mayor Sawyer for the first hour of the work session.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Motion's been made by Counselor Hall, seconded by Counselor Goble. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Motion carries. May we have the city manager's report, please?
Sure. Tonight we have three things that we'll be talking about in open session, and then we're requesting that the council schedule an executive session immediately following the work session after the presentations are completed to discuss negotiations. So one of the things that we're going to reverse the first two items because Chris Rampley, who's part of that discussion, is currently on a call, and so hopefully he'll be back for the second session. So we'll start our discussion with the room tax, and then we'll go on to discuss the fire department staffing, and then the last item on the agenda is discussions regarding tree issues. And we are anticipating about 20 minutes per piece for those sections. So, so at this point, let's talk a little bit about room tax. One of the priorities that the council had discussed earlier was looking to get legislative flexibility on the use of room tax funds collected by cities. At the April 4th work session tonight, we'll be discussing opportunities to address the increased flexibility in spending transient room taxes collected at the city level. In preparation for the regular legislative session that will occur in January of 2023, one of the first opportunities we have to kind of get something in the pipeline is through the League of Oregon Cities legislative processes. Their committees have been established and the Finance and Taxation Policy Committee will have their first meeting on April 12th. So I think we have an opportunity to get something in the pipeline for their consideration at that meeting to look at increasing the flexibility and the use of room tax. Under current state law, 70% of the taxes collected through room tax must be used for tourism promotion or tourism-related facilities, or to finance or refinance debt for tourism-related facilities. For the city of Newport, since we had our original formula grandfathered in when this law took into place, the first 9.5% of the taxes collected are split with 46% being used for tourism and tourism-related facilities and 54% for general governmental operations. Other cities like Depot Bay, prior to them increasing their room tax rate, were able to use 100% for general government operations. Because again, they were grandfathered in and so that's the system that they use. And a lot of the tourism communities up and down the coast have much more liberal provisions that were grandfathered in and they're allowed to continue using. Now, same issue occurred with Depot Bay on their increase, because they also increased their taxes up to 12% after we did. But on that increase from what their rate was prior to 2003 and the rate afterwards, and I think it's probably 2.5% similar to us, they have to spend 70% of that on tourism and tourism-related facilities and 30% on general governmental operations basis for the new money that they're levying. The city council can discuss a little bit about the type of flexibility should be built into the use of the room tax. I think the one thing for the council to be aware of is this is an item that has a lot of substantial lobbying capabilities to try to stop this, because this has been an issue that has come up in other years. I think that's a political reality in this particular area. My general thought is really narrowing down the scope and potentially look at floating by the League of Oregon Cities a provision where we could use the tourism portion of the tax, not only for tourism promotion and also tourism facilities, but potentially folding in streets and perhaps even more. Councillor Jacoby and I were talking about public safety as a component, things that are directly impacted by the number of tourists that are in a community. And so for this first segment, wanted to give the council an opportunity to discuss this a little bit. I do have on the regular agenda an authorization of a letter to the LOC, if we can come to a consensus of, you know, kind of what we're looking at for this. But I think if we go too broad on this issue, I don't think we have much of a chance of getting that through. If we can kind of narrow the focus to things that are directly related to tourism, I think that would be good. One of the examples I use in the report here, why I think roads might be something that are definitely things that are used by tourists in communities. And again, we're talking beyond the city of Newport. We're talking about all communities in the state when we're looking at legislation. You know, you can compare two communities of the same size people. City of Newport is 10,000, and I use Monmouth as an example. Independence is in that same ballpark. We're all about 10,000 people. The road network that a tourism community of 10,000 people have is substantially greater to meet the various needs of the traffic coming in and using attractions in that community. And in the state of Oregon, though, when we get state, the state shares the gas tax they collect, it's all on a per capita basis. So regardless of whether we had 100 miles of roads and 10,000 people, and Monmouth might have 50 miles of road and 10,000 people, we get the same amount of money. And so in a sense, a city like Monmouth with a smaller road system gets a lot more money from the state to maintain their road system than a community like Newport that that has a much more extensive road system because of the nature of the tourism and seasonal housing that we have in this community. So anyway, if we can get a little direction at this meeting this afternoon, that'll help form a motion for council to consider approving at the regular meeting tonight to try to get this concept in the hopper at LLC for their first finance and taxation committee meeting.
Councillor Parker?
I would very much be in favor of streets being included. The intersections 101 and Herbert, 101 and 20 are terrible right now. Now I know that some of that's ODOT's responsibility, but rather than create a new bureaucratic process, small cities around the state, but especially on the coast, and especially Lincoln County, where we have three east-west state highways more than anywhere else, we need relief. And if tourism brings revenue, then tourism infrastructure will continue to bring that revenue. And I think we definitely need to make sure that we have a better streets budget, and TRT seems like the most logical source of increased street repavement, pothole mitigation, and overlay funds.
Councillor Kaplan?
Just for reference, how much do we bring, what's the total amount ballpark that we bring in the city for the tourist?
I'm right in the middle of budget right now, so this is a dangerous number for me to come from the top of my head, but I believe it's in just the tourism portion is in excess of $2 million.
So the tourism, so that the more is collected, that's
goes through the general fund.
Okay, so
yeah, the so total I'd say be combined, we're probably pushing that $4 million. Okay. Mark, and I may drastically revise these numbers when I look at the budget when I get home tonight.
But, I'm going to hold you to it.
Yeah. But that's general scope.
Okay. That's helpful.
And just as a primer on that, remember that our three parking districts create around 220,000 a year, and the need is around 650 or 700, according to that study that Aaron made. Am I remembering that correctly?
For parking or for roads?
For The needs of roads each year is around 700, right?
No, I think the needs for, I'm not gonna guess that. I've guessed that one already, but it's a substantial amount of money that our needs are in our road resurfacing, and I think it was closer to 2 million. I think the amount that we're putting in is about 700,000 a year. So we have this huge gap just to keep our roads in the same condition that they are today. When we don't fund that full gap, the roads continue to deteriorate, and we don't have the funds to reinvest in that street system in order to keep them at least where they're at and hopefully improve them. So.
And right, and on that, I'm going to venture a guess that a lot of the Orla lobbyists don't live in Newport, but if they do, they can feel free to send me a lot of direct mail about it. So I also feel that this is a livability issue for the people that pay taxes in the city, and it's essential that we give as many direct services to them as our budget allows, as far as safe roads, striping, crosswalk safety around the schools. All those things are dependent on what we budget for, and as our population in the summer swells, those critical needs become more obvious. And I would propose that we look at some sort of 60-40 split instead of 70-30 as a compromise with Orla, and maybe even realistically 50-50 would be ideal, because the world knows about Newport, thankfully, and I think that the more we can beautify the city, the more it makes sense to reallocate tourism promotion dollars to tourism infrastructure improvement dollars.
Yeah, just on that particular issue, what I think I would recommend to the council is that roads be added into the tourism portion of the calculation, just as tourism facilities are and tourism marketing. So that's it would broaden that to allow roads to be part of the tourism portion, because we can spend the other portion on anything we want, including we could spend that on roads if we wanted to. But we're really restricted on the tourism promotion and tourism facilities portion of that. So if we added roads to that mix, that would be a huge help in trying to keep our road system up, utilizing a portion of those funds for that purpose. Now, there might be some pushback, and there could be some discussion and compromise if this thing gets any legs to it. But I think that's a reasonable ask for the city.
Councillor Hall?
There was some conversation a couple of meetings ago, I think, about including even the rec center and aquatic center as a part of what is our tourism facility, what is a tourism facility. So as I'd like to see that broadened so that would be something that we would consider in that respect.
Yeah, and right now, and that's kind of a separate question, the by ordinance, the council can determine the percentage of a facility that's either tourism related or not. And we do fund a portion of things like the rec center and the library and the PAC and the VAC using the tourism portion of facilities. But that's something we're looking at as part of this budget process to see if any of those numbers should be addressed. And that can get addressed during the budget committee meetings as well. So we do have flexibility there. Council has to use some reasonable judgment about, you know, what percentage is tourism related. But there may be an opportunity to take a look at increasing that, particularly with the increase we've had in the room tax. We've got a little more flexibility on how we use those funds. And that would be legitimate under the existing structure.
Well, I would like to mention the public safety issue. Tourism has a great impact upon the calls that our police get and the fire department. And of course, we need more people in both of those departments, but I think particularly the police. I think I've heard Chief Malloy say he would love to bring back the bicycle patrol. That would be so good in the summertime when we have tourists all over. So I would like to see that component better funded.
Well, and to that point also, because it's coming out of the community service officer, I think, for any calls on VRDs and such like that. I think that's just all a part of the public safety piece. So I concur.
Yeah, it would be good to have a SRO on the weekends.
I don't think you mean SRO.
I mean the STR CSO? Officer on the week.
Yeah, okay.
CSO, excuse me, yeah. Councilor Goble.
So, Spencer, of that $2 million that you indicated as a tourism portion, does that include the 54% and the 70%?
No, that is the 70% on our new tax and the 46% of the former 9.5% tax.
Okay, so that makes up the $2 million, right?
Correct.
And of that $2 million, what are you talking about putting into roads?
Undetermined at this point because we can't put any of it into roads.
Yeah, but I mean, if you had your
well, it would seem that potentially, you know, and this was, you know, a little thought I had on this issue is that potentially, you know, 50% of the tourism portion could be used on roads and or public safety if that's a component the council wants to propose as well, you know, of the tourism portion. And because I think if there's an effort to take all that away, or if there's a perception that all that could be removed from tourism promotion, I think it's going to create a substantial backlash that would probably not make any of this happen.
Yeah, I think if we go to the legislature and say we'd like to add streets, I think that's enough for their brain to fathom and get it in. If we make it too broad, then I think there's a lot of confusion.
Yeah, the broader you make it, the more challenging it is to go. But I think if there's a basis for it from a tourism standpoint, it might be worth putting in the mix and negotiating our way through this. But
because right now I think we're spending, we've given the chamber additional monies above and beyond what their budget is, and we're trying to figure out how to spend it. So I mean, if we can take that and divert it to roads and infrastructure, I think that's a good way to go, yeah. So I'd be in support of that. And I think, are you talking about drafting a letter for this next
session? Yeah, and when we get done with the discussion, I'll tell you what I think I heard, and you can tell me if I heard it right, so.
Councilor Bateo?
I'm wondering if we are talking about tourists, we are also thinking about bathrooms, like a shower or bathrooms, full bathrooms, maybe in the future. You know, I know that some tourists, they look for opportunities to utilize, you know, sometimes bathrooms, sometimes, you know, stores that are closed or, you know, I don't know if that is something to consider.
Yeah, and right now, based on the council's formula, 90% of bathrooms are funded out of the transient room tax as a tourism facility. So we're funding 90% of those costs right now for public restrooms out of the tourism portion of the tax because that's a legitimate. They really are there a little bit for residents, you know, they're there substantially for, you know, the people visiting Nye Beach and the Bayfront and wherever we have restrooms. So.
Any other comments, Council? Yeah. Councilor Parker?
The street segment goes from 9th over by the cottage, the log cabin building, over to the chamber and needs to be rebuilt and resurfaced.
And again, that's
to part bring of that the, point home, yeah.
And that's part of the transportation plan. And once we determine what we're going to do there, we'll know what we can start planning to how that should be built. So, but it is in rough shape. So, and the sidewalks are in equally rough shape along that stretch. So. So,
okay.
Going around the table, the only question I have, it seems there's a consensus that roads be part of the flexibility of spending on this. And then I heard from a number of people on public safety. So I guess the question is, do you want to go forward with a letter to the league promoting both flexibility for roads and public safety, or one or the other?
Well, I'm confused what you mean by public safety. I mean, what do you actually...
Police and fire.
Police cars?
Police and fire.
being able to use funds to offset police and fire expenses.
For what purpose? I mean, what are we doing?
To meet the tourism.
Buying equipment or what?
No, generally into the operating budgets to staff positions to...
Staff position?
To meet the needs that we have in a community that is 50% tourists in the summertime. So right now, our residents are burdening that full, you know, brunt of those expenses.
Okay.
Councilor Kaplan?
I hate to interrupt, but I really would be very strongly in support of funds for public safety. And I think about the fireworks in the summer and whether we like them or not. But that, you know, we've had fires on the beaches and lots of illegal fireworks, but the police department does not have the manpower to even look at it. And those are tourists. Those don't tend to be locals who are doing dangerous stuff on the beach. And that's again, one of the costs of tourism.
So maybe just a show of hands. It seems that everyone supported streets as part of the funding. Is that true? Okay. And then show of hands, is there a majority that support including public safety as well? Okay. So we'll get a motion together for the afternoon or the 6 o'clock meeting to kind of formalize that, and we'll move on to our next topic.
Councillor Hall?
So there's already a motion in the agenda. Are we going to be seeing a letter before that? Is that what you're saying? Okay, just wanted to clarify.
You're going to be authorizing us to send the letter.
Cool.
So. And it'll contain both elements of, I guess the last part of that too, we talked about, you know, limiting those expenses to 50% of the tourism taxes. Was there comfort in doing that? Because again, I think that's going to be more saleable than saying we aren't going to spend anything on marketing.
It's an improvement from the status quo, so I'd be up for that.
Huge improvement. So.
And when it comes to letters that we sign, it'd always be ideal if the letter would be available at the following meeting, so we don't have to come in on a separate.
Yeah, the catch with this letter is I'm just going to have you authorize the mayor and I to send it, because it has to. If we're going to get this in the pipeline, it's got to go out before the next.
Great,
meeting,
even so. Better.
Okay. Spencer, we'll go on to the second item.
Yeah, which is the first item in my report, and that's discussion regarding fire department staffing. I've invited Chief Rob Murphy, Andy Parker, IAFF Local 4619 President, and Chris Rampley. And did Chris get back?
Uh-huh.
Yep. Okay. To meet with council to discuss staffing issues with the fire department. In the proposed budget, I will be recommending that we establish 3 additional firefighter positions. This will add 1 firefighter per shift, bringing the total number of firefighters on each shift to 4. Please note, with vacations, schedule, sick leave, significant issues of vacancies, which is becoming more and more of a problem, it's more likely that we will have average staffing of 3 per shift if we had 4 on the shift. The reason I'm recommending this is oftentimes we're down to 2 firefighters working on a shift. That still may happen, but to a lesser degree under this new staffing situation. Based on OSHA requirements, we need a minimum of 4 people, 2 people in and 2 people out, to enter a building that's engulfed in fire. When we're operating with 2 people on the shift, if the chief and assistant chief, when we get that position filled, are available, they can help meet the standards. But oftentimes, we have these situations where we have to wait until backup comes from another department in order to fill these needs. The level of qualified and trained volunteers is very limited at this point, and it's not something that we can regularly depend on. So with a limitation in staff, it puts us into a very difficult situation in many calls that we get, particularly fire calls. And the other issue that is occurring more often is having a couple calls at once, which then a decision has to be made as far as what call we can actually respond to. We are getting offsetting a portion of these costs by additional funding in this upcoming fiscal year from the Newport Rural Fire District. They should be able to levy about $50,000 additional funding, which they've tentatively agreed to do as part of this process. Furthermore, we believe that we'll have a reduction in overtime by about $100,000 with the added staffing, which helps, again, meet a portion of this gap. With the changing dynamics that we're experiencing in fire services, I don't really believe there are any good alternatives that can be implemented to assist us during these challenging staffing times. And even with the additional positions, there may be some challenges in hiring firefighters to fill these positions. At this point, turn it over to Chief Murphy for a few words, and then if you can turn it over to Andy and Chris for the balance, that would be great.
Sure, will do. Thank you, Council. Rob Murphy, Fire Chief. I'll keep my comments brief, but I think Spencer did a real good job of summarizing kind of the situation that we're in as the fire department. And that is, we are seeing increased demand for services, and we have unfortunately less volunteers than we've had in the past. Volunteers that are not able to fight fire like they once were, and it's become basically a critical mass for us as far as being able to provide basic fire services to the community. Even just today, we had to ask to have the agenda moved. So, because I only have two on the engine today, and I needed one of them, Chris, to be here, and he had to be on a call. And we're seeing that more and more. Spencer briefly mentioned more than one call at once. We, 10, 12 years ago, we would see that about 8% of the time. We are now approaching about 25% of the time, where we have more than one call at once. That's regular for us now. And the crews regularly have to decide that, which call has a higher priority, put the other one in pending, and we're gonna take the higher priority one, and then we'll get to the lower priority one when we're done with the first one. And they go from call to call to call to call. So we're seeing that more and more. The need for additional staffing has become very acute. The difference in just having one extra person on an apparatus, going from two to three, makes a huge difference. And then if you can go to four on an apparatus when they first arrive, is a game changer as to what the crew can do immediately to suppress a fire, to have offensive fire operations, versus simply a defensive mode and waiting for more personnel to show up. So with that, I will turn over to to Andy and Chris and let them give their comments. Thank you.
Good afternoon. So we sent out a letter a little while back, and I guess if anything, I know that kind of covered a lot of the stuff in going along with what Spencer and Chief Murphy had talked about. Really what we kind of wanted to use some of our time with is any questions you might have. It definitely, there's not a whole lot of options. Staffing is going to be something that really helps us out. It just doesn't solve the ultimate problem, but it is something that would definitely make things better.
I think it's worth noting too that if we have that situation where we have multiple calls, if we've already made patient contact with on a medical call, we are not allowed to leave that patient until the ambulance shows up. So if we pop the fire across town, at the same time the heart attack's going on, something's got to give. So Lincoln City is in the same situation. They're a little bit busier than we are, but they've recognized that, and they're staffing two engines as of this summer.
And the chief's not exaggerating on the time. So my last shift on, we ran into exactly that. We had four calls going at once. One of those calls where we had to commit to a beach call and had to delay multiple other calls to go deal with that. The summertime is even worse than just the average. And with that additional influx in town and things going on, literally spending most of the day, a 15-call day is not uncommon. So it really gets going quick.
Yeah, any questions from the council?
Councilor Hall?
Sorry. Thanks for being here. So as I'm reading in the report submitted, the current firefighting staff right now is 9, and the population I think is a little bit over what we have for our city, but even so, it's 12, and we are putting, we're aiming to put 3 positions in the budget. So I guess my question is, it sounds like there's also a recruitment issue. So even if we have the positions, there's still an issue of hiring, training, having them ready. Is that, am I also capturing that accurately?
Somewhat, and I'm sure Chief will probably want to chime in on this one as well. Currently, we have 9 full-time positions. For the last 2 years, we've been running at 8, trying to get those filled. Between the process of recruitment, the actual hiring process of getting folks on, and then if we're lucky enough to get somebody that's trained and experienced. With the trend in the fire service, what we're starting to see is bigger departments right now are really hurting. They're really drawing from the smaller departments. We're feeling the effect of that. One of our more recent hires, that 2 years ago, we picked a guy up, a really good firefighter. We're going to lose him to the Portland metro area. That is going to be something that our police force has kind of already seen, and I think we're just a little behind the times in that. But you know, and then with that population increase is becoming challenging.
So kind of going back to my question, is there an active hiring process, or do you need the approval for these positions to have an active hiring process?
I'll let Chief jump in on that one.
Yeah, or Spencer.
Well, so part of that I'm going to defer to Spencer as to how he wants that to start. Obviously, we need Spencer's approval before we start any hiring process. For the firefighter that will be most likely leaving us this summer, we can start a hiring process for that right away. As far as the additional ones, that obviously will require council approval and budgeting for those positions. Just to make sure that the council is aware how we staff. So we have 3 shifts that run 24 hours each. And so by hiring 3 additional firefighters, it will put 1 additional person or FTE on per shift, going from 3 per shift to 4 per shift.
Yeah, just on the hiring process, if we know that this is in the pipeline, we'll be able to create a hiring list potentially from the position that we know that we have a vacancy on. And I think by the time the times correspond, we'll know how many vacancies we have to fill, whether it's the 1 position or the 4 positions as I'm recommending. So,
and one of the things that we are looking at, we're constantly evaluating our hiring process, and it's a balancing act between trying to be as expeditious as we can with it, but also to make sure that we have a quality process, that we get the right person the first time. And I think with our last 2 hires, we've shown that if we do our due diligence, we get good quality people, and that's what we want.
Councilor Goble?
Yeah, some, 2, 3. Did you say it will bring the present shift to 3 or 4?
It would bring it up to 4. It's 3 right now, a captain, an engineer, and 1 firefighter.
Okay.
And it would go to a captain, engineer, and 2 firefighters.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for coming, guys.
Right now, we're running at 2.
You're running 2 with it.
Last 5 days have been 2 most of the next month.
2 firefighters and a command?
Well, like right now, we have an engineer and a captain on. Most of the time, because of vacancies, illness, vacation, things like that, usually that number is going to be down. It's probably safe to say about 25% of the time, we're going to be at 4. I would say about 50% of the time, we're at 3, and sometimes we'll be down to 2. It just kind of happens.
So you're responding to 4 calls at the same time? Is that what I heard you say?
Occasionally.
Yeah.
We did just the other day.
Yeah. Some time ago, I think the council went through your call list, and we determined that there were some calls you didn't have to go to and other calls that we wanted you to go to. How is that working out? I mean, are you following that protocol?
We are following that protocol. We have seen some... I think we've seen some limited success with that. It is something that, in fact, we were just talking about that, about maybe looking and reevaluating that. One of the components that we have to deal with is our dispatch center, Salem Dispatch, is in the current process of putting in a new CAD system. That is an 18-month-long process. And for us to go to them right now with changes in what we respond to is not a good idea. We may have to be patient and wait the CAD process out until that gets into place before we can consider any changes to what we respond to. But in the meantime, I think it's we're due for a good analysis of that, and we'd be happy to report back to the council.
Yeah, I know when you came to us with that request to limit the amount of calls you go on because you were concerned about the call volume.
Yeah,
and we were working with you, and we were hoping we would solve a problem, but it sounds like they're not solved.
We have seen some relief from that. We have, but as time goes on, and you know, we've seen call numbers creep back up, and they go back up, and I see no reason for that to change. Just as we have seen in our community, we have seen our tourism come back. We've seen more people in town. And that corresponds to a greater demand for service. So I think it's just kind of more of a natural evolution, if you will, as opposed to any failure that we had.
And then if in fact you're having trouble finding people and you're having one person leave, are you think you're going to have success hiring four new people? And how are you going to do
that? We're not going to see them this summer, certainly.
To hire a new firefighter, by the time we go through a process, depending on their qualifications and experience, it could be an easy 1 year to get somebody in and trained. Also availability on the training itself. Being we could end up having multiples with people leaving per shift, that still puts us in a bit of a crunch along with the amount of call volume and getting them trained in between there.
So how much of an overlap are we going to have on overtime and new staff? Is that something that's going to happen over the next year or what?
It's almost, you know, again, that's something that they might be able to answer a little better. It really kind of depends on if our last person we hired was ready to hit the road running. They were a very qualified, capable candidate. We can't guarantee that everyone's going to be that way. And so that's part of the hiring process that the chief's got to go through and look at and say who best meets the need, what's available, and what works best for us.
In the meantime, staff is going to continue to do overtime until you get the position.
We're not going to be able to sustain the levels we've done the last 2 years. We tried very hard with the chief working with us to keep the engine at three people, but I averaged 90 hours a week last week year round.
If it's going to take a year to fill, you're gonna have to put in the overtime, right?
We're not going to work 90 hours a week all summer.
No, I understand what you're saying.
What will happen is we'll end up with the engine down to two, which is the minimum, and it just makes it tougher on the guys working that day.
I sympathize with you, and hopefully
with all the overtime to come back in.
Hopefully, we can get Spencer to fill those positions right away, right?
Yeah, if you fund them, we, you know,
it's on you, Spencer.
One of the challenges is, you know, on the hiring process and on just the whole nature of employees today versus, you know, even back a few years ago, folks are incredibly mobile now. They will come to work for us to get the experience, and we become kind of a farm team for the larger departments, and unless someone's got, you know, some local connections here, you know, we're going to always be at risk, you know, of losing someone that gets enough experience where they can move up into another position. We'll be talking after this, kind of briefing you on where we're at in negotiations, but you know, part of the issue also is the pay structure that we currently have, particularly for the firefighters, and that's something that we are planning to address in the contract that's been jointly negotiated, and we'll brief you on that a little later. But it's a challenging time for any jobs. Are we gonna have to
rob them from somebody else?
We're gonna have to double our volunteer role, and we're gonna have to sign up as recruits, is what I'm hearing. To sign up as volunteer firefighters.
Yeah, well, and understand, even as volunteer fire departments, there's a huge training requirement for those volunteers
to go to a burn later this month.
A little more.
We have another comment by Councilor Bateo.
Well, touching CEM's comments about volunteers, I think any department in the city, I think, you know, the volunteer is very important, but I'm wondering, you know, how we can support, you know, to bring it to the community and build that relationship, you know, and they know that, you know, the deficits that we are having, but also building that relationship that, you know, the people feel comfortable and say, oh, you know, I can see the fire department is needing volunteers, so how I can get engaged. So I know that everybody's busy and there's no time, but I see the need in building that part and also bringing that to, you know, like at the college, like having open house. I know the fire department, the police, they do a really good job pointing the community, but all the departments, how we can bring that to, you know, at large, so we are sharing with the community that we have these deficits and we are willing to take that. But also, you know, volunteers is very important, but what kind of incentives that we are offering to volunteers to be part of this institution? That's another part. Marketing, very important too. So we have to dedicate some money for marketing too, because if we don't dedicate some money on marketing, we will continue with this. And marketing is very important. Also, you know, with our, you know, media users, they would like to see more marketing. Like if the fire department has a need for volunteers, how we can post it very in a nice way to deliver so the high schoolers and the college, they can see this, you know, and they can say, oh, they have a volunteer work. I can probably do it. Are they offering some incentive to be a volunteer? Because everybody is going to college. It might be, you know, something as support to get there. Yeah.
Yeah, the volunteer issue is something we've had a lot of discussions about. And one of the challenges we currently have is really being able to support with the staffing that we currently have the, you know, a volunteer program. I mean, we're basically, you know, pretty much fully engaged in service. And it takes staffing and it takes dedication to manage that sort of a system. And that's, again, we're in the process of an offer has been made on a new assistant chief who's in backgrounds right now. And that's going to be one of the discussions that we have is how can we use this position best to do some of the stuff, yet meet the other requirements that we have as a department. So it's been a challenge and it will be a challenge going forward. But it's something that we've had discussions and recently Chris Rampley and the volunteer folks spent some time taking a look at some steps that could be potentially implemented to try to build that program up and you know that's something that we need to figure what the right pathway is to do it within the means of what we have to actually support that kind of a program.
We have one more comment by Councillor Hall.
Just to tag on to Councillor Botelho Salgado's comment, it does say here that you have one entry qualified volunteer who responds regularly. I'm guessing this person is the sentence is there's like a word missing, so I'm guessing that you say you have one entry qualified volunteer that responds regularly and only when pulling a stipend shift. So you do offer stipends to some of your qualified volunteers. That might be another opportunity to speak to what Councillor is saying around how do you further incentivize people to step into a volunteer role?
Absolutely, yes. And we do offer stipend shifts. And you mentioned about incentives. Really, everything you brought up has been stuff that we have discussed, that we have talked about, and strategize as to how do we improve that, and we're going to continue to do so with, you know, with what we can. And it's also engaging the volunteers we do have, saying, you know, what we are offering for incentives, is this still what you want? Do you want something different? Is there other things we can do? Marketing, you mentioned, very important. We have a job fair coming up in 2 weeks, I think. And that'll be part of both for staff positions and for volunteers as well that I'm going to be participating in. So we're looking at all that. We absolutely are. There's no easy answers, we are looking at everything that we can look at. And we're having the same discussions, same ideas that you came up with.
One of the challenges we do face locally is we don't have a big pool to draw from. There's a lot of retired folks, a lot of people that keep busy. There are a huge amount of requirements that are put on volunteers, not to mention just 60 hours of fire training, if they do any medical type trainings, things like that, and the incentive stuff that's out there. It's very challenging for folks nowadays to have a job that allows them time with their family, come in, put time at the fire station. And you know, I started with the department about 20 years ago when we were running about 700 calls a year. And I remember volunteers that if you didn't make 50% of the calls, they're really kind of what's going on. Nowadays, we're running 2,300, 2,400 calls, and to even ask them to make a quarter of that is not very realistic. It just doesn't happen. And a lot of the calls we're running nowadays, too, are things like assisting somebody up off the ground. And I'm sure Dietmeyer can attest to this, as back in the day of going on a structure fire or something, you know, cutting up a car, there's a little bit of excitement and a little bit of adrenaline that goes with it. Going to lift somebody off the ground at 3 a.m. for the third time that night, it really is kind of has the opposite effect on the volunteers. And so we realize as staff, that's what we catch a lot of are those calls, but we're not seeing the volunteers as much with that going on. And usually we'll see them, if anything, a little more during the
after the third or fourth time your pager goes off at home next to your wife's side of the bed and it's a non-emergency, you get a lot of pressure from your spouse to turn that thing off.
Yeah.
And so the sheer volume of non-emergency stuff has had some dampening effect on participation. Yeah. And people are just busier. The requirements are different. When you guys were on there, I hear stories of if somebody, their training was, they were thrown in the fire building, and if they turned around and ran back out, the engineer put them back in again. the requirements are a lot more stringent now.
Well, we thank you. We're going to have to move on in our schedule, but please, may I assure you, Chief Murphy, Mr. Parker, and Mr. Rampley, that we support you. We'll do everything we can as a city to get this better for everyone. Thank you.
Very much. Thank you for
Spencer,
your time.
Anything
thank you for
else?
Your time.
No, I think that summed it up well. So,
what do we need to do to get three new? Has that been the determined already? We're going to hire three new positions.
The council will be asked formally on that in 2 weeks. To give direction on that.
Okay.
The last thing we have today is discussion on tree issues in the city of Newport. This is an item that Councilor Jacoby initially raised, and what we wanted to do is give a brief background on kind of what we're doing, and then Councilor Jacoby has some information she wants to share, and then we'll have discussion after that. And you can introduce your head table there, Mike.
Good afternoon, Council. I brought along our department's tree experts. So we have Anita Albrecht, who you guys are all very familiar with, our city landscape specialist, and then also brought along Scott Bernard. Scott, I just want to, one, introduce you guys to him. Scott came to us from Tualatin Hills. Very lucky to grab Scott. He has been a breath of fresh air on the park side, but he is the new park maintenance supervisor. So wanted to introduce him also, and then what I can do. Sorry, instead of holding the button there. What I wanted to do and just kind of describe to you guys in the staff report was just where the city came from, where we are currently, and where we'd like to project and move forward into with the tree program. So 2011, as you guys see, we went into the Tree City USA program. That is with the Arbor Day Foundation. And we have been enrolled in that program. Each year we recertify to be a certified tree community, and we've been doing that for 10 years. That is really a baseline for the program. It's not something we want as a department to be striving for, and it's just to create a healthy tree environment in a local community, and then also it gives you kind of the base standards, and it also gives the community the opportunity or the department that is running that program, overseeing that program, gives us the opportunity to celebrate Arbor Day with the community and better aware the community about Arbor Day and trees. This past year in 2021 was our first year that we achieved a growth award. And the growth award is a little bit deeper dive into the program to providing a more sustainable urban forest for a local community. It consists of gathering 10 points over five different categories. In each category, the projects or the opportunities or the goals that you strive for has some sort of weight and points for the scales, and we have to collect 10 points per year. And then from within the tree, from becoming a certified tree program, that led us into having three ordinance put together over the 10-year period. The last one was, I believe, in 2019. And those kind of just kind of provided a structure for our city program as a whole. Ordinances for the management and of the program, providing responsibilities for our Parks and Rec Advisory Committee for being the tree board, some visual line of sights for the municipal code and zoning. And then the bigger one was the 2019 ordinance, and that was the ordinance that kind of that really dove in and provided a lot of structure for the program, provided a workflow for city staff, how we go through these requests that come into the city for removal of trees or tree trimming, presented and created standards for city staff for development, for planting of trees, and it also gives kind of a guideline for the community members as they're trying to do work within the right-of-ways. From there, you know, just as we move forward, some ideas or an idea that I threw into the staff report was a tree inventory. And that would be a great next step for us as a city. There's a lot of things that come with the tree inventory. We just recently had a meeting with the new city or GIS coordinator or GIS specialist through the IT department. We as staff have been having internal discussions prior to meeting with the coordinator about enrolling into some state programs or potentially requesting through the budget process funding for software or for additional volunteers or staffs for this program to provide a tree inventory for the city. But our ArcGIS software has that capability. We were very encouraged and really excited when we met with the GIS coordinator. And so there's some momentum there. I do think I provided a sample of Portland's volunteer program for tree inventory. It takes a lot to run a program like that, as you just kind of read through their little pamphlet. So there's the opportunity for using volunteers, or we could even do a city arborist at some point. That would be a fabulous thing that would even count towards some of our growth awards within the Tree City program that we're part of. And so that's just kind of a general idea of where the history of us, where we're at presently, where we want to go. And then a piece that I forgot to put in the staff report, and it popped in my head when I was down at Cape Perpetua this past weekend, there is the Oregon Heritage Tree Program. And that's a statewide program, but there are also where you can propose a potential tree to be recognized within that program. I think Lincoln County has two trees. There's one tree in Lincoln City, and then the tree down at Cape Perpetua, the big spruce tree, Sitka spruce. And some of our trees might not qualify for that, but we could also tailor. There's plenty of local communities that have similar programs like that that we can tailor just that is managed within the city. And so there's opportunities there for additional growth where we could go into a heritage tree program. And I'll let the two of them, if they have anything, Scott can introduce himself and first put him in the spotlight there.
Good afternoon. I'm new to this, sitting in front of a council, so bear with me a little bit.
We won't bite.
They only bite me.
I grew up at Tualatin Hills, spent 31 years there, came in and developed an IPM program for them, revamped it, been in the chair of the IPM committee. I went through the Street Tree Institute through State Forestry, graduated that program in 96, and then sat on their committee that actually chose heritage trees across the state. So I've got a little bit of knowledge on that. I went to school for forestry for the first few years. And so I got a number of botany classes and dendrology classes under my belt, so I'm pretty well. At least in the valley, I can do pretty good. Over here, I've taken a little bit to get adjusted to it. So I've got quite a few years in parks. So I don't know if I need to say anything else about that. If you guys have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Councilor Parker.
I have multiple questions.
Good.
Look at you. Do you have an applicator license?
Yes, I do.
Excellent tool in the toolbox. Are we in the council comments portion? Are we still doing?
No, this is
okay.
This is so, council's turn. So
I don't know if you've fashioned a gaze around the county and around the city right away, generally, but I would characterize our urban canopy as extremely stressed and very unhealthy. You have to drive through 5 miles of even stand dug fir, completely encased in ivy, just to get into town. It gets worse in North County. And there's other roadside invaders in South County. And so it's great that we can put up a sign that says Tree City USA, but half those trees in the city limits are toast unless we find some budgetary way to go after the Helix hedera and the other species of ivy that's around. And it takes, from personal experience, 20 to 30 minutes per tree just to girth it. And so if you're thinking of tens of thousands of trees around town, I think we need to set up a program to kind of create the talking point of private landowner responsibility in this, because I've seen it time and time again where public lands are cleared and then the infestation goes under the roadbed, or which is the case in Depot Bay, or up and over. We have a big corvid problem here, which you're probably familiar with in the valley, and they're the vector for eating the ivy berries and spreading it everywhere. And so it's a tall order. If we could maybe look into some of the Monterey cypresses in town. I know that's an introduced tree, but there are a number of them that we could create our own little city heritage tree bike tour, because a lot of those are on the multi-use paths. So there's some good and some bad, but I just want to make sure you can spend the time to go around town and recognize some of the challenges that we have. And I volunteer to tear the Band-Aid off, but I've talked to ODA and I've talked to ODF about the issue. And I mean, as a comparison, Toledo's a Tree City USA too, and completely overrun by ivy in the entire town. And so at what point do we need to move away from the old view of looking at that plant and saying, oh, it's pretty? When do we ask state regulators to stop actually selling the plant? Because it's still for sale at commercial nurseries, despite taking over 14 Western Oregon counties. And it's a multi-million dollar impact to economic activity and timber production, which is huge here. And so that component of a urban forest or urban forest inventory, probably there needs to be a waiting component to where we can say, this tree's toast, cut it down. This tree can be saved. Let's get a volunteer corps together to girth the trees in this right away, or spray these weeds or whatever it becomes. But it has to be more actively managed. And that's not just a problem in the city or the county. It's in the entire state, really. West of the Cascades has a huge problem. It's very expensive and time-consuming. So my hope would be that you can at least start to communicate the scale of what can be done with a volunteer corps, what can be done with city staff, what can be done with consultants, and see what the Venn diagram of that looks like.
I've had a little bit of experience with ivy. I've learned a little bit from the city of Portland. I've known some of their forest park managers, and I've dealt with or talked with them about the ivy, because we had it in Beaverton also. We had a board that directed us to remove ivy from around our 50-meter pool. It was just a huge hillside of ivy, and we contracted out the removal of it. now you got a bare bank. So now you got to revegetate it with the proper plants. So it's not, it's a two-faceted thing. You can get rid of it. It's not that difficult. It's time-consuming, but it can be done. But take select areas, manage it in those areas, and then replant with something that is natural for those areas instead of just letting it go.
Okay. Well, thank you. I'm really, really glad you're here, Scott. You'll be a great addition. Yeah.
Thank you.
Were there any other questions from the council right now? Yeah, I was particularly interested in getting a tree heritage program going for the area. So I'm glad that's something that you've worked with before and that you're interested in. You know, I'm really interested in another item that was in our packet also, the tree pruning and removal program. What has actually been done with that? When trees have been removed from the right-of-way or private.
As in documenting?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, that has been a challenge because we don't have, it's something Spencer and I have discussed where we need to get all departments involved on that. And that's something that we've noticed in the last year. Anita's been in a big role with getting us recertified for the program. Mm-hmm. And that was a discussion we had, I think, about a year ago with trying to document. That was one thing that I noticed coming into the department head roles. We didn't have good documentation even within the department of what we were doing for trees. I know since anything from the public side, that's documented through the right-of-way system mm-hmm. permit application process, but internally with city staff, that's something that needs to be refined a little bit more because we noticed that there is a spreadsheet that we shared. I think it was shortly after that time period that I shared with several department heads in regards to documenting so we can then retrieve that data at the end of the year for the recertification process. But we have since then realized we actually need to open that up even broader. We only shared that with Public Works. Recently, the trees situation that's out at the airport, that would need to be included. So we're going to have to develop this as a full citywide program. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Councilor Goebel?
Yeah, you just mentioned the tree heritage program. I think that's a good objective. Now, my immediate concern there is it public-private? Because a lot of the heritage trees are on private property, especially our cypress trees. I know that we had cypress in South Beach that were cut down to put a motel in. Beautiful set of trees. And how do you deal with that as far as, you know, some of the specimen trees on private property?
The program that I was involved with the state, we did consider private property. Most of the property owners were very willing to have their significant trees documented and put on the registry. So most of the time people are willing to work with the groups.
But it's not mandatory to participation?
No,
we're not looking at programs that are similar to the state program. It's an application nomination process, whether it's from the public or from city staff. You know, for public or for private property, it would be the landowner making that nomination for their tree.
And in such a brochure that you could create, you could do what the North Coast Land Trust does up in Tillamook and Clatsop County, is they do an annual tour of big trees on private property where it's prearranged and guided. They also just note, you know, no trespass. If there's a tree, maybe they just include a picture for reference and appreciation. So there's a lot of plug-and-play models of how to blend a heritage tree program to mention that there are a lot and have some kind of hometown pride aspects, but also, you know, here are the ones you can go to, open to all. Although I would hope that the aquarium would be amenable to being a partner with the city because we've recently green-lighted some of their projects, and so it seems like mm-hmm. that'd be fun for them to tell their own visitors and their parking lots. Mm-hmm. There's these huge Monterey cypress, and the ones on the bayfront are spectacular, and so, you know, that's it's there's some use of some tourism promotion dollars right there.
We recently had a staff member that traveled to Hawaii, and she shared she stumbled across their, I guess their, the equivalent of their heritage program, and for their state program, they actually have an incentive for those that private property landowners that are the owners of a heritage tree. They have an incentive for a tax, from a tax side. If you're maintaining it, it's a tax write-off. You know, obviously that might be, we'd have as a city do maybe a little different, but there's ways we can maybe encourage and incentivize the private residents to apply and nominate a tree.
Right. Councilor Bateo?
I just wondering, you said how many heritage trees there are here? How many kinds?
In Lincoln County, there's two. Only two trees.
Oh, really? For
in the state program that's involved with the state program.
Oh, state programs. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. I just kind of was wondering. I was thinking, you know, that would be nice to know, you know, also, you know, trees that are, you know, that are native. Like, you know, me, I know some of the trees that are native, but some of them I don't know. I think this is a nice information to have. And I'm thinking, you know, like last year we had the weather change and impact several trees, you know, on the coast. Probably we noticed they were kind of dry, you know, and some people that were asking some questions about how they can manage better, you know, the weather change. I don't know, Scott, maybe there's something, you know, to support the population with some information on, you know, with weather change, how to manage trees and keep it, you know, healthy. I think it's very challenging with this weather that we are having every year. I don't know, maybe there's something that we can incorporate.
And that's, you know, a piece to just being certified as a Tree City USA. We really want to encourage more knowledge within the residents. And, you know, we've done some Arbor Day foundations over the past couple of years. And again, this year, we're going to do another one that we received grant funding for. With handing out trees over at the library. And something Anita and I recently talked about was, you know, designating some of our budget dollars for printing of the tree manual so we can hand these out to the individuals in the public. And that's something, you know, you guys mentioned earlier for the fire department, you know, marketing. That's something that we as our department haven't done a very good job of for this program. And that's what we're shooting for in the future. That's the best way to create awareness in the community. So,
Councilor Goebel, and then we are going to have to wrap this up.
I was just going to say I've got one heritage tree in my office. When we remodeled the Ripley's down there, they pruned all those cypress trees, and I got a seed pod from it. I put it in a pot, and lo and behold, a tree grew out of it. So it's a little cypress tree growing in a pot.
That's great.
Yeah,
Well, thank you. Thank you for coming, and I look forward to Arbor Day and the trees of Newport. I think we have to move on to our next session.
Yep. Thank you, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you all. Need a motion to go into executive session.
Move to go into executive session pursuant to ORS 192.6602D. To consult with the city's labor negotiators.
Second.
It's been moved by Councilor Goebel, seconded by Councilor Kaplan. All in favor?
Aye.
Say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay. We are now in executive session. Yep.
And we're gonna move to the conference room for executive session.
Okay.
Which your light dinner awaits you. So
okay. Can we do a
fire
break? Can we just have a fire break?
Sure. When do you want to reconvene?
5 minutes?
5 minutes? Quarter after?
5 minutes.
Reconvene in 5 minutes.
No,
it should be open now.
Oh, okay, great.
Yep.